Blog Talk Radio.
Of the Center for Professional and Personal Ethics at Central Michigan University, where I also teach philosophy. And if you are a regular listener of Ethics Talk, you know that students typically host the show, and this is the last show for a while in which I will be doing the show with a special guest. Actually, the next airing of Ethics Talk will be this Sunday. That's January 17th, and the title of the show is Habits and Value and the and a values-driven life, and the show will be actually an experiment, and Ethics Talk will be broadcast not only on Blog Talk Radio, but also simultaneously on Modern Rock 91.5. The time is 5 to 6 p.m., and Nick and Emily will be back doing that show. But tonight, I have a really special guest on the line, Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, subject of the Academy Award-nominated film, The Insider. Dr. Wigand, thanks so much for joining Ethics Talk.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to it. How are you this evening?
Thanks. I'm great. Thank you for asking. So I want to say a few things before we start getting into the discussion with Dr. Wigand. One is, if you have listened to the last two episodes of Ethics Talk, they were both on the subject of insight, or what we've been calling the aha moment. And we're doing this show tonight with Dr. Wigand because it fits really nicely into the past two shows. So in one of the shows, we talked about the aha moment as having what I referred to as an affective signature. That's affective with an A, in contrast to effect with an E. If you're not familiar with the term affect with an A, it's a term used in psychology referring to pleasure, pain, and emotion. And what we have said in our past episodes is that aha moments can be both pleasurable and painful. And so the discussion last night will pick up on that thread. The second show that we did on the aha moment was really about the different types of aha moments. And so if you're interested in just this topic, I recommend you to look at those shows, just ethicstalk.cmich.edu, click on show archives. Tonight, our objective is to have you, the listener, appreciate that Dr. Wigand's decision to do what he did, which I will briefly sum up in a minute, probably most of you know, but in case you don't, I'll sum it up. What his decision to do what he did not just sort of happen to him, but rather it arose out of a series of disturbing aha moments. And our objective is to sort of take you through the inner journey of Dr. Wigand, of his psychological processes, and of the disturbing insights that he had along the way that ultimately compelled him to break ranks with the tobacco industry. I should also say that we're not going to be taking calls tonight because we really want to get Dr. Wigand's story out there first. But Dr. Wigand has agreed to come back and do another show, and so we will be taking calls at a later date. But for tonight, it's just going to be Dr. Wigand and his story. If you don't know who Dr. Wigand is, he achieved international acclaim pretty much when the movie The Insider was made. He is the subject of that film, The Insider. And Dr. Wigand, when was The Insider made? Was it 1999?
1999.
Okay.
First aired in October of 1999.
Okay. October of 1999, the movie The Insider comes out. And it was really that film which put Dr. Wigand in the international spotlight. The film is it's almost 3 hours long, and it's extremely complex. If you're a Netflix subscriber, Netflix categorizes it as a cerebral film, and I think that's completely accurate. I know that I had to watch it a couple times to really understand. But the fact of the matter is that the story is complex. It involves not only Dr. Wigand's decision and all of the other things going on the side, but also, famously, it involves the decision of CBS 60 Minutes not to air this very famous interview with Dr. Wigand, where he basically came out and told the truth about what he saw as an insider at Brown and Williamson. So the film is complex. I should say that few people know that the film was based on an article called The Man Who Knew Too Much by Marie Brenner. This was published in Vanity Fair. Was it 1996, Dr. Wigand?
May of 96.
Yeah, so if you can actually get that article on our website, ethicstalk.cmich.edu, just click on Show Resources, and the article will be there in a PDF form. I should also say that Dr. Wigand has his own website, which is excellent, jeffreywigand.com, and there's a lot of resources there. So with that, again, our objective is to have you understand that there was really a number of disturbing insights that Dr. Wigand had that ultimately led to his decision to publicly come forward in a very, very public way, not through the local paper, but through CBS 60 Minutes in an interview with Mike Wallace. And so, Dr. Wigand, as I understand it, this really like the first disturbing insight that you had happened pretty early on after you had been hired by Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company. And what year were you hired by Brown & Williamson?
I was hired actually in 1988 after 6 months of interviews with all the executives in both in Brown & Williamson and the holding company and parent company. I officially joined the company on December 31st of 1988 and left the company in March of 1993.
Okay. And so it was really quite early on that you started to realize that this was not the right fit for you. And as I understand it, there were some observations that you had of lawyers. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, within the first 3 months, there was what you call an aha moment, and not such a pleasant one, where I was really part of my orientation sent to a law firm, Shicardi & Bacon in Kansas City, accompanied by the assistant general counsel of Brown & Williamson. And the purpose of the meeting or the visit to very large law firm that had been interwoven with the tobacco industry for decades was to give me the appropriate language to speak in public so that I was consistent with the legal strategies of the companies and also at the same time would not say things that are contrary to the company's external mantra. I would say that the 3 days that I spent in Kansas City in February, March of 1989 were asking me to believe things that had already been established for at least four decades in the scientific arena, such as the Surgeon General's reports were faulty, the IRAC reports were faulty, the WHO reports were faulty, and their intent was that I would absorb this contrary opinions should I ever be, A, in a public venue and have to express an opinion on either nicotine or the hazards of smoking, or I was called to be an expert witness or testify in any type of tobacco litigation. And it was quite upsetting to me because they were asking me to believe things that were contrary to things that we had discussed during the six-month interview process and were why they were asking me to do this. Lawyers were now teaching me or attempting to teach me lawyers have never taught me before.
So Brown and Williamson, this wasn't made clear, but Brown and Williamson is in Louisville, Kentucky. So you're flown from Louisville, Kentucky to St. Louis, Missouri to this law firm. And the purpose of this trip is for the lawyers to coach you how to speak. But it also sounds like they're also trying to convince you. I mean, were they just trying to, because you're a scientist and...
Yeah, I mean, it was in 25 years of corporate experience, I never had lawyers really interfere in science and actually twist and turn the science such that it fulfilled their legal platform. And their legal platform was the following. One is there is no direct causality between tobacco use and any form of disease. It has never been proven in a clinical trial. Second is that it's all, and it was all nothing but statistics. There was no true epidemiology or cause and effect or causality. The second part is that nicotine was not addictive, and because their legal platform was one, as long as it's not addictive, it therefore does not remove from the user their autonomy to make a good and rational decision. And that it was there for flavor or taste. And this is contrary to what my discussions were prior to joining the company, and we're in direct conflict to my own training and scientific education. And it was quite disturbing.
So they were trying to convince you that they were trying to get you not only to say the tenets of their legal platform, but also to actually believe it. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, they wanted me to believe it, but also they wanted me, so to speak, to colloquially, is this, to carry that bucket of water, which I had tremendous difficulty doing because that's not what my belief system was, nor was it consistent with the existing science that was in the public domain from the public health community, but also within the industry's own documents.
Okay, so... you're flown for this coaching on how to speak. And so that's, you know, disturbing aha moment number one. And then what happened after that?
Well, I basically went back. They were going to send me reading material on a continuum basis for me to read. But I guess the next large aha moment was that there is what was called the research policy group, which consisted of all the BAT companies' heads of research and development throughout the world. Canada,
BAT is British American Tobacco. And that's the holding company.
That is
BAW.
The principal company located in the UK.
Okay.
And we met with all the scientists, with no lawyers present, to discuss a myriad of scientific issues, how to coordinate research, how to use resources, what was in other people's files that we had not been shared, how do you make a fire safe or a reduced ignition propensity cigarette? If you were to develop a safer cigarette, how would you test it, and what would be the biological criteria that you would use to establish a level of safety? How would you modify nicotine either through genetic engineering or other molecular biology forms? What types of smoking and health research would you do? And just a host of discussions, and where we basically enunciated clearly and succinctly that, yeah, we understood nicotine was addictive.
Mm-hmm.
We understood there was harm caused by tobacco use, whether it be smoking or other tobacco products, and that the recorder of the sort of secretary of the meeting, Ray Thornton, captured the minutes of the meeting, which were roughly about 12 of 13 pages of summary of the meeting. I wouldn't say a verbatim summary of the meeting, but captured the essence of really that nicotine was addicting, that smoking was dangerous and harmful. And it was a belief that was consistent throughout all the BAT companies, particularly not just in the scientific area, but throughout the company in other areas.
And this is, you know, important because given what you just said about you're flown to St. Louis, Shicardi and Bacon, you're taught, okay, this is how we speak. We basically endorse this legal platform that nicotine is not addictive. There's no causal connection between smoking and illness. And here at this meeting, the RPG meeting, the Research Policy Group meeting, you have a bunch of scientists getting together saying things that completely contradict that external mantra, but are consistent, as you've been saying, with what people are saying within the company. And the bad thing, as I understand it, is that the minutes that you're talking about, because those minutes captured in a legally discoverable form statements by executives that contradicted what you've been calling the legal platform of the company. Is that correct?
That is correct. And when I received the draft meeting minutes that to make some technical corrections, I made some technical corrections, which I felt was in the essence of making it clear and concise and succinct. But then also, as you do in management, you generally circulate up your work product to your boss. And my boss at that time was Tommy Sandifer, who is the president and chief operating officer of Brown & Williamson. And when he received the minutes, he became, well, I guess the word I would use is considerably exercised, that I had participated in a document that put in the hands of an adversary would put the company in significant harm's way. And he summoned me to his office. And to join him were the CEO and chairman, Ray Pritchard, and the chief general counsel, Mick McGraw. And I won't tell you that, you know, it was a most pleasant experience, but they most certainly chastised me for even participating or being part of that type of discussion. The next thing that happened was really a very large aha moment, was that they called a lawyer, J. Kendrick Wells III, who was the assistant general counsel, who was not present at the meeting, to actually take the minutes of the meeting and sanitize them such that in the hands of an adversary, these documents or this document would not put the company at risk. And he basically took the 12, 13 pages of minutes and reduced them to 2.5 pages of vanilla, and that was going to become the permanent record for a meeting that was held by the scientists.
And what year did this happen in?
I'm sorry?
What year was the vetting of the RPG minutes?
The RPG meeting was in September of 1989. The vetting of the minutes and the final issuance of the minutes was in November of 1989.
Okay, so this is really early on in your career.
This is early on, and we were asked to, you know, to turn in our copies of the meeting minutes that was sent out, and for everybody to collect them, and they were to be destroyed.
Right, and I just want to...
And they were to be replaced by this 2.5 pages of vanilla.
Yeah, and the reason why I'm just highlighting the date is because, again, you know, we're trying to really have the listener appreciate that your decision to come forward with something gradual that took a number of these aha moments, and we're right at the beginning, and I believe you said that you were at Brown & Williamson until 1994, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so this is in 88, 89, all right, so we can say that, you know, Dr. Wigand stayed on for several years after this. So we can, like, group all of these disturbing aha moments as, you know, the sort of perception of these legal misdeeds and giving you a look into the corporate culture there and how lawyers were involved in that corporate culture.
Well, the lawyers became intimately involved in all scientific matters. And, I mean, that's kind of the next aha moment, which is,
right.
I mean, it's just a continuing escalation of the culture within this company and its parent company. I mean, the minutes, issues of the minutes reached the chief executive officer of BAT Industries, Sir Patrick Sheehy. And Sir Patrick Sheehy, in conjunction with the Solicitor General of BAT Industries, summoned all of us, that is all the heads of research for the various companies, that's from Canada, from Brazil, from Germany, from England, from the United States, and from Australia, to be in New York City and accompanied by their legal counsel of the company. And during that meeting in New York City in January of 1990, we were instructed how a lawyer would be in every facet of scientific research, document production, document generation, and adherence to the policy of creating any document that would put the company in harm's way, such as the use of the word safer cigarette or illnesses associated with tobacco use or addiction. Those words were actually verboten. And the very law firm that gave me my first orientation was invited back to Brown & Williamson to instruct the research and development department on how to write documents that would not be beneficial in the hands of an adversary. And so they now have created a system by which documents that were generated overseas were passed first through a lawyer overseas, and then they were passed through the same lawyer I mentioned before, J. Kendrick Wells, and they were sanitized, they were vetted, sometimes they were sequestered, sometimes they were sent back to overseas, and actually in order to protect these documents from ever being discovered, the company drew up a new cost savings agreement, which basically allowed the, even though the company funded the research overseas, allowed the company that produced the potentially controversial document or report to say that they had ownership of it and could request it back at any time.
Okay, so the important point, because we're almost like at the half hour mark, but you're clearly aware that there's this culture here. Lawyers are involved; they're instrumental in this culture of, well, quite frankly, fraud. And
fraud.
You don't come forward at this point, okay? What were you aware at this point that you had made a serious career error, or what's going through your head at this point?
Well, I would say, in January, after the January meeting, it was very clear in my head that I had made a serious error in judgment and believing that I would be able to go to this company and make a, quote, safer cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And two is that they were never going to live up to that, because if you had a safer cigarette, everything else that they've been selling would be unsafe. And it really bothered me, because I had to do a balancing of my values. I mean, what was more important to me at this time, coming forward with this information, or really dealing with my family and the needs of my family, or should I continue working for the company and focus on other issues? And what I basically did is I chose that I wanted to protect my family, my health care benefits, which were very important to us,
mm-hmm.
as well as look and focus in other directions, such as in some of the 600-plus additives that are added to tobacco to facilitate the initiation process and the continuation, the youth smoking, and a host of other things that were not focused on safer cigarette, but focused on other areas, so that I continued to do what I thought I was hired to do, but also had some degree of belief, being a vice president in this organization, that I would have the capacity to alter the culture. Again, that was a mistake on my part. I could not change the culture of the company.
All right. So under this belief that you can change the culture, you begin to look at additives and, you know, you go back to work. You had, I don't think we mentioned, but you had moved to Louisville from the New York City area.
Yeah.
You had uprooted your family, and there were personal reasons why you were there, grandparents and so forth.
Yeah.
So it's totally understandable, right, that at this point, it's lawyers, it's their problem. I'm just going to, you know, as a vice president, I can actually try to do it. That was a mistake, as you say. But then something else happened that I'm really thinking about, and the movie The Insider actually does mention this. But I'm talking about the issue of coumarin, and I wonder if you can talk about what happened next after you decided to investigate additives and with coumarin in particular.
The coumarin issue, I mean, there were many other issues that came up that gave me real pause for thought or continuation of the aha moments. And I guess the coumarin issue is sort of the nail to the coffin or the final thing that kind of pushes me to really challenge some of the practices in the company. And I had received a copy of a preliminary report from the National Toxicology Program on coumarin. Now, coumarin is an additive that's been added to cigarettes, but was banned in 1954 by the Food and Drug Administration because it was toxic to animals and a mass foul odor, and therefore was banned from use in both cosmetics and food products and importation. In spite of being banned, the company continued to use it in one of its particular products, so Walter Raleigh aromatic pipe tobacco. And what concerned me with this report that it said it was carcinogenic. And my concern was one that now knowing, A, it's first been banned because it was toxic, B, now it's been shown to be incrementally more dangerous and harmful, that it should be removed. And what I basically did is took it to a toxicologist that I hired, and I had him basically go through the same calculations I went through, and there was complete corroboration of my calculations and his calculations, and I then went to the president and chief operating officer, Tommy Sandifer, and said, hey, based on this report and based on our calculations and what we have come up with, coumarin must come out of this product because it puts the user at incremental harm. Mm-hmm. And his response was, that wasn't my decision, that I was going to go back to the laboratory and find a substitute, and that it was his decision to keep coumarin in. Of course, if you took coumarin out, which is much like vanilla flavor, would basically change the taste of the product, and therefore, as you change the taste of the product, you would lose sales, and therefore, that was his responsibility. I subsequently wrote an extensive memo that I could. It was just immoral to continue to use coumarin when we have this knowledge. Several months later, Mr. Sandifer became the new CEO upon the retirement of Mr. Pritchard, and I was summarily fired for poor communication skills in March of 1993.
Okay, so just to recap, because we're now at we got about 30 minutes left. And I have seen callers calling it on the switchboard, and I want to say we're not taking calls tonight. Dr. Wiegand, we just want to get his story out there. It's extremely complex. I'm hoping that we do it in the next 30 minutes. I don't know if we will, but Dr. Wiegand has agreed to come back, and he will take calls as soon as we get the whole kit and caboodle out there. So my apologies for hanging up on several callers. But, okay, so just to review, you see these lawyers telling you to basically say things that you yourself don't believe, that there's no scientific connection between smoking and health, that nicotine is not addictive. You get a report that there's a lung-specific carcinogen being used in one of B&W's products. You accordingly go to your superior and say, we need to take this out. Your superior, Tommy Sandifer, says, no can do. It's going to impact sales. Go back to the lab and try to find a substitute. And eventually that issue did lead to your termination, correct?
Yeah, I think that was my writing the memo and the tenor of the memo, which was, I mean, not impolite, but firm, basically caused my termination.
Okay. So, and after you were terminated, as I understand it, they meaning Brown and Williamson, were not honoring your original employment contract. Is that correct?
Yeah, they asked me to sign. I was called into Mr. Conhorst's office early in the morning when I first arrived, and he basically says they were terminating me because of poor communication skills and wanted me to sign this agreement, which was, in terms of its terms and conditions, was substantially different than the original agreement by which I was employed with, and I wouldn't sign it. I was escorted out of the building without being able to remove my personal property or any of my papers from my office. They basically said I could not go in, and I was escorted out by security. Several days later, they sent me in a box what they thought were my personal property, like my passport, pictures of my family, my briefcase, etc. And I proceeded, because I wasn't going to, I thought I had a contract law issue, I was going to find a lawyer who would represent me in the state of Kentucky on a contract issue with a tobacco company, and I was unable to get a lawyer to represent me. Because my intent was to sue for the original terms and conditions. Which I basically, from March to June of 1993, spent time searching out for a lawyer throughout the state of Kentucky. And ultimately in June of 1993, arrived at a termination package, which was not exactly what I had agreed to at the beginning, but it was equitable to me. It
okay.
allowed me to have no offset on my any earned compensation. It actually released me from going to work for another tobacco company, which was prevented in the original agreement. And it continued my health care benefits, and it continued my substantial severance package or salary.
Okay. So you guys are able to come to an agreement, so you do sign this contract, and not so bad, as you're saying, and then what happens?
Well, basically, all I wanted to do is go back to where I should have been in the medical biomedical area. That's where I came from. That's where I basically spent 25 years in senior level positions. So, that's what I wanted to do. In September of 1993, the company sues me in a legal action in Jefferson County Court, ex parte, that is alone, no legal representation on my part, for allegedly violating my confidentiality agreement, the original one I signed, which was basic boilerplate,
mm-hmm.
by telling somebody my salary.
Mm-hmm.
And they immediately stopped all my severance package agreement and sought an injunction against me. However, on the other hand, they had this, I would say, draconian onerous agreement that if I was to sign that without any new consideration, a new severance contract, that they would reinstate my health care benefits and my salary continuation in my agreement.
Okay.
And this agreement was quite onerous. That is, anything I had learned, saw, observed during the 4 years and 3 months at the company, some of it being immoral, unethical, and in many ways, I would say, illegal and fraudulent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I could not disclose to anybody who asked me without two conditions. A is that I had to inform the company who was asking for this information. Two is that they had the right to have their legal counsel present. And I guess the third part was it had to be done via a legal instrument, i.e. a subpoena.
Okay. And you do sign this second.
I did sign the agreement because I at that time, I really didn't know what to do with what I knew and how to deal with it. My focus.
So this is in 1994, 95.
Now we're in 1994.
Okay, 1994. Okay, and just to remind people, the movie The Insider is made in 1999, and Dr. Wigand begins working at Ronald Williamson in 1988. Is that correct?
Yeah, December 31st, 88, but
okay.
For all intents and purposes, January 1st.
Okay, so we're now in 1994, and you sign the second agreement. And you're not at this point, like a decision to come forward, as we're saying, this is not just something that happened to you. We're seeing something grow over time. And with 25 minutes left, I don't know if we'll see the actual, green shoots of the decision. But as I said, if we don't get to it, we will be back at some other date. With the rest of the story.
You could be assured of.
Okay. Okay, and so you sign this more onerous agreement that requires you to disclose to Brown Williamson whenever you are contacted by some sort of legal person.
Anybody.
To give testimony. Anybody.
Anybody.
Okay, and that they can be present when you speak to somebody else about what you saw at Brown and Williamson.
And they could actually almost script me in terms of how I would respond to questions.
Okay. So you agree to do this, but meanwhile, this is where Lowell Bergman comes in. Lowell Bergman, in the movie The Insider, is played by Al Pacino. In the meantime, you sign this agreement, and Lowell Bergman contacts you from CBS 60 Minutes, and he has some documents from Philip Morris. And I just want to, this is important because the documents that you looked at that Lowell Bergman gave you, they were given to him by somebody, I think his name is Dr. Butts or something, is that correct?
Mr. Butts, yes. They were sent
to
Lowell Bergman anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say initially when I received calls from Lowell Bergman, I refused to accept them.
Mm-hmm.
And he ultimately said, well, I just want to show you several documents, and I need your help to decipher these documents. And actually, he came to Louisville, Kentucky, and I met him at one of the local hotels, the Seal Bach, and explained to him I had this very onerous and secrecy agreement, and that he couldn't talk to me about Brown and Williamson, nor would I answer questions about Brown and Williamson. And should he do that, I mean, the conversation would be terminated immediately. And he basically said, this is not about Brown and Williamson. These are documents from the world's largest producer of tobacco products. And,
mm-hmm.
I said, well, who's that? And he said, well, it's Philip Morris. And I said, well, what do you have? Because I believe that I can, under this agreement, use my scientific knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to interpret these documents, and that's what they were. These are documents that were titled the reduced ignition propensity of a natural incendiary device.
Oh my goodness!
Code for fire safe cigarette or reduced ignition propensity cigarette. He did not have with him all 2,300 documents. He had about 6 very select documents.
Okay, so the important point is that these are documents from Philip Morris, not from Ronald Williamson. And so they were not within the scope of your confidentiality agreement. And you were very explicit to him that should he ask you about Ronald Williamson, you would not and could not say anything. And you had no duty to notify Ronald Williamson that you were talking to Lowell Bergman because, again, this is concerning Philip Morris, not Ronald Williamson.
That's correct. And actually, that was memorialized an illegal agreement between myself and CBS 60 Minutes.
Okay. And here's where it really starts to get complex, and we do have 20 minutes left, and so we will try to be as clear as possible. And again, Dr. Wigand will be back. We did foresee that this would happen. But we're at the point where Dr. Wigand has the documents from Philip Morris, courtesy of Lowell Bergman, and some anonymous source from Philip Morris that has now been given the name Mr. Butts, as in cigarette butt. But also at this time, and here's where it gets really complicated, the United States government, both the FDA as well as Congress, are on the move. And the FDA and Congress, I'm just trying to speed things up a bit, but the FDA is looking at gaining regulatory authority over the tobacco industry, which we finally did. The FDA finally did get that authority. Was it like last year?
Last year.
So,
finally.
Yeah, it took a while. So, and Congress serves you with some type of congressional subpoena, correct?
Now, they didn't serve me with a subpoena. I mean, after the seven CEOs testified in April of 1994 that nicotine wasn't addictive and that smoking was no more dangerous than Twinkies.
Mm.
Prior to that testimony, I was contacted by staffers of the Waxman Committee that was going to question the seven CEOs.
Mm.
And they asked me if I could help them develop the questions and give them an understanding of tobacco science and chemistry and addiction. And I said I'd be more than willing to testify in front of Congress under oath if and only if you can get me an appropriate legal instrument, i.e. a subpoena.
Right. And at this time, you did disclose to Brown and Williamson that this was happening.
After several conversations with staffers of now Senator Wyden and Congressman Sinar and Congressman Waxman, and there were repeated calls. And I felt an obligation that under my contract, which I did not want to violate, to tell the company that I had been contacted by the U.S. Congress and that I would be accepting a subpoena to testify or to help Congress understand what went on in the tobacco industry. I then notified the general counsel of Brown and Williamson of these discussions with Congress and congressional staffers. And quite to my surprise and upsetting to me was that I received two death threats, two verbal death threats that were not addressed to me per se, but were addressed to my two young daughters, which basically said if I was to do anything that would put tobacco in harm's way, that my children would pay the price. Those were two calls that came at two separate times, and they really sent a chill up my spine because I had learned, at least during my tenure, that the tobacco industry did not treat people who are adverse to their way of doing things well, and I wanted no part of it.
Right. So you see this a connection between you telling Brown and Williamson that you're about to talk to Congress, and then you subsequently get these death threats. And at this point, as I understand it, you basically decide not to tell Brown and Williamson what you're doing, and you decide to secretly work with the FDA under the code name Research. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's covered in David Kessler's book, who was the commissioner of the FDA, and the question of intent. I was starting to wonder and trying to understand, what do you do with what you know, and what is my moral responsibility associated with the knowledge that I had, not only for my own moral compass, but for all the lives that could be saved vis-a-vis the knowledge that I had of what went on in the industry. And I was contacted by the Office of Special Investigations for the Food and Drug Administration, Jack Mitchell, and my agreement with Jack Mitchell was I would be more than happy to help the FDA understand tobacco science, why one tobacco, nicotine enhancement, free nicotine, and all the issues associated with tobacco science and chemistry and addiction with several conditions. A is they would have to treat me anonymously and protect my identity, and two is that I would only deal with the FDA commissioner himself rather than dealing with somebody in the bowels of the organization. And they so agreed. And so I traveled back and forth from Louisville, Kentucky, to Washington, D.C., and to Bethesda, Maryland, several times, and I took the FDA commissioner, David Kessler, through the science of Y1 tobacco, that is genetically engineered high-nicotine tobacco, using ammonia chemistry to boost free nicotine and addiction, and many other elements of it, and they protected me by codenaming me Research.
And sorry, I would say that this is like really, you know, the green shoots of your decision. So here we see you taking, you know, decisive action. And what year is this where you decided to work with the FDA under the codename Research?
Well, it was in 1994 through 1995.
Okay, so 94, 95. And
it was
so,
right after the seven CEOs got up in front of Congress and I believe deliberately and consciously lied.
Okay, and so you make this deliberate decision, I am going to do something with what I know and I'm going to help the FDA, but you're doing it secretly. And I think, you know, this is an important point because this is before you make the decision to go public, and as I said before, not merely by, you know, speaking to the local paper, but in an interview with Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes. But before you had made that decision, you sort of started to feel your way out, I would say, by working with the FDA secretly. But then something happened which said, you know what, this is not enough, and I need to go public. And so it was watching the CEOs lie, and was there anything else, was there any other disturbing event that led you to say, you know what, I'm going public, and I'm going on 60 Minutes?
Well, I mean, in June of 1995, I became a reviewer of several Journal of American Medical Association articles written by a professor of cardiology at UC San Francisco, Stanton Glantz. And these articles were based on research programs that had gone on at Brown and Williamson prior to my arrival, and which I had no knowledge of. I mean, I had never seen them. And I was asked to referee or review these articles for JAMA and validate the names in it, validate the programs. Many of them I had never seen before, and many of them I had asked for to see before, you know, research on nicotine, research on modification of a cigarette, modification of other tobacco delivery devices. And that really caused probably the last aha moment before I decided that I needed to go and become no longer a bystander and take knowledge public.
So that's interesting. So actually reading these documents that Dr. Stanton Glantz had, watching the seven CEOs lie in front of Congress, actually caused you to perceive yourself a little bit differently, and you saw yourself as a bystander, and you saw yourself as somebody who was complicit in this, and that probably made you feel rather dirty, and you decided that you had to come clean and come out into the light, and that's when you decided to go on to 60 Minutes.
Yes, and I mean, I had worked with 60 Minutes on the Fire Safe cigarette in early January of 1994.
Yeah, we haven't even mentioned that.
I'm sorry?
We haven't even mentioned that, and I mentioned the story.
Yeah, I had worked with CBS 60 Minutes after that meeting with Nassil back with Lowell Bergman. I actually took on that project.
Mm-hmm.
I was paid $12,600 to do these 2,300 documents, which actually became an investigative report in April of 1994 called Up in Smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And I had maintained contact with the correspondent, Lowell Bergman, and with Mike Wallace over the ensuing period of time. So on August 5th of 1995, I basically decided that I am going to come forward in the public domain which would give me some degree of protection and would also at the same time reach 30 to 40 million people on a given Sunday night. And so I decided to go public on CBS 60 Minutes and give a full disclosure of many of the things I had shared with the FDA, but I did it with some caveats that I would maintain custody and control of the taping, that I would need a lawyer and be able to have a lawyer before the program could air, and there needed to be some form of physical security or protection for my family, because after the death threats, I was concerned about the retribution that would occur to us if I went and when I went forward. So I had a document executed between myself and CBS 60 Minutes to that effect. And so on August 5th of 1995, with this document, this agreement in hand, I basically did the interview with Mike Wallace on everything I knew about the inner workings of not only Brown and Williamson, but I had also been an expert witness in another legal case in which I got to see another company's documents, which I'm not really allowed to speak for, because I still have what they call an evergreen restraining order about discussing it.
All right, we'll just move on then.
This is the final, if you want, aha moment. This is the defining moment. This is the moment when I truly know now that I am breaking the agreement, and I am now opening up myself and my family and putting everything in harm's way for the truth.
And I'm going to just do a quick and dirty summary of a lot of complex things with 8 minutes remaining. But basically, Brown and Williamson somehow learns that CBS has the interview in the can. Somehow they learn it. Nobody really knows how they learn about it. But somehow
there is
Brown and
speculation
Williamson,
on that.
Okay, well, it's speculation. But they learn about it, and they threaten CBS with
a lawsuit.
A lawsuit of what, billions of dollars?
$15 billion. And it's helpful, I guess, to put this a little in context. The CEOs and the owners of CBS also own the tobacco company.
Mm-hmm.
And they also were part of the testimonies in April of 1994, so they were under investigation by the Department of Justice. And also, at the same time this interview is being vetted and validated, Brown & Williamson and this tobacco company are conducting a multi-million dollar, $100 million plus product transfer.
Right. There's all these complicated issues involving 60 Minutes, and with 7 minutes remaining, I'm trying to steer us away from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story in itself.
It absolutely is a story in itself. I just want to get back to you and your inner journey, as we've been calling it. And so B&W gets wind that they have this interview in the can. There's all these other things about a product transfer, blah, blah, blah. And basically, to cut to the chase, CBS 60 Minutes famously, caves and decides not to air the original program and so forth.
October,
and
in October 1995, they canceled the program, the interview,
right.
And they actually put on a muted voice in a back screen that they could not air the interview with a senior executive of a tobacco company, and that it was because of the confidentiality agreement and this principle called tortious interference.
Right.
Which means that another party interferes in a contract of other parties.
Right.
And they basically have canned the interview.
Right. And so you've basically made this conscious decision to do something rather difficult, which, as you said, you are knowingly violating your agreement. You're basically spilling the beans in front of Mike Wallace. It hasn't aired yet, but you knew that it was going to air at some point. So it's sort of like the psychological momentum had started, and you had, to use a phrase, come out into the light. And this interview gets canned, and I can't imagine that, but there's something that happens even after that, and we have 5 minutes left, and we're really trying to rush through something very complex. But I'm really getting at the Mississippi depositions, which were also...
Well, before the Mississippi deposition, the whole interview some way makes the transcript of the interview makes its way into the public domain, particularly the New York Post. And the New York Post gets a full line of the transcript. My name is identified in it, and I am sued in a Kentucky court by Brown and Williamson for violation of my confidentiality agreement, fiduciary responsibility, et cetera. And they are suing for unspecified damages, and that occurs in October, November of 1995.
Okay. And so now there's another lawsuit pending against you, okay? CBS is not airing this instrument. New York Post has the whole thing printed up. Brown and Williamson sees that they sue you. And then something's happening in Mississippi, and we have 4 minutes remaining, so be mindful of the time. And
well, I mean, quickly, I am served with two subpoenas. First, I'm sued by a subpoena from the U.S. Department of Justice called a civil investigative demand on the whole issue of reduced ignition propensity cigarettes, or sometimes called fire-safe cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Venue, Pascagoula, Mississippi. Mississippi happens to be the first state to file a litigation under novel conditions against the tobacco industry. And as I come into the state of Mississippi, I am now served with another subpoena to testify under oath now everything I told CBS 60 Minutes in a Mississippi court, a chancery court.
Okay.
During the morning, I discussed with the Department of Justice attorneys my full understanding of the issue of fire safe cigarettes, that it could have been done in 1986 by Philip Morris, and they basically stalled it. They called it Hamlet, the burn or not the burn. And they could have brought that product forward and saved hundreds of thousands of lives. You know, roughly about 1,200 lives a year are lost to cigarette-caused fires.
Mm-hmm.
But as I'm giving this deposition to the U.S. Department of Justice, Brown and Williamson is trying to block the afternoon deposition in the Mississippi action, but also going back to their favorite judge in Kentucky and seeking a restraining order and a contempt order, that if I was to go forward with that legal instrument in Mississippi deposition, that I would actually be incarcerated. And that actually brings you almost to the midpoint, where I come back from the deposition in the morning and I am informed by the attorneys that are there, the Attorney General of the State of Mississippi and Ron Motley, and the Department of Justice attorneys, that if I was to go forward with this deposition in the afternoon, that I most likely would, upon returning to Kentucky, would be immediately incarcerated.
And
which gave me significant pause for thought.
Yeah, and I wanted to highlight that because we have 2 minutes left. We're going to get cut off soon. So I want to sort of end on a coherent thought, which is that, okay, and eventually you did give the deposition, and it's very dramatic in the film The Insider. But the important point is that even after you've decided to come, to go public, when you're pointed out that you may go to jail for giving this deposition, you hesitate, but you did actually give the deposition. So it's not this epiphany, continuous process. There's speed bumps along the way.
No, it's not a single aha moment. I mean, it is not an epiphany.
Right.
It is almost like building up momentum.
Yep.
And a balancing act that one must go through.
Yeah, and even when you've built up the momentum and you're going downhill, I would say that there's still these moments of hesitation, like, what am I doing? And so it's a very, very difficult thing to do psychologically. And with that, with like 30 seconds remaining, I just want to thank you, Dr. Wygand, for sharing it.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for helping me through a very complex and, I mean, tortuous story. I mean, there's many other details I can share with you and the audience, and we'll do that another time, and we'll certainly give people an opportunity to pose their questions.
Yes, we will have Dr. Wygand back, and we will have the phone lines open then. But like I said, I wanted to get the story out first, and we almost did that. So check us out on Sunday from 5 to 6 live, or check the archives, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. And have a great evening, and thank you very much. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.